From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. It's a special edition of To the Best of Our Knowledge because Nathan Englander is our guest producer. Nathan, your most recent book, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, won the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award and was a finalist for the 2013 Pulitzer Prize. You're also a novelist. Clearly somebody who's given a lot of thought to where creativity comes from. Why here? Explore the extras.
Yeah, I guess for one thing, this is a new form, and I've become obsessed with collaborations and new forms and trying new things. So the idea of working on an hour of radio was super exciting. Everybody who writes, we talk about the muse and the zone and inspiration and all these really romantic notions, and it sort of feels almost like a spiritual idea or religious idea or trying to put, you know, words to something. But it was when I was writing this last book, it just became clear to me that creative work is being done when I'm not conscious of it. The muse is a thing, but it's not a thing outside yourself. It's inside, and I guess I wanted to try and pinpoint that place.
So how does the creative process work, do you think?
I've been writing my whole life, and it never ceases to be a mystery. Like, you know, I'm starting a new novel now, and it is as exhilarating as it is. It'd be dishonest to not say it is terrifying in equal measure. Whether, you know, you're Joyce Carol Oates or Peter Carey or someone who's, you know, putting out a book a year, if not two, you know, this notion that every time you start, you're needing to find your way into the world and find your way back into the space, and it is not accessible from the consciousness that I inhabit right now. The me that is talking to you cannot see my way into that space. My deep belief after years of sitting is that there is another consciousness. Like the me that's talking to you falls away and there is another space that takes over. And that's why we're not talking to just a stream of writers today, is because I want to hear what happens in a theoretical physicist's head, what's going on in an actor when she becomes someone else. This is what I'm after.
So let me get practical for a moment. When you start a new story, a new novel, a new play, what do you do?
First, I go mad. Like, I think that's, I really think that's the point that's built in. A whole novel can come to you as sort of a smell or a feeling. The idea of translating that into words, it's finding your way into another place, into another head, into another consciousness. I am working unbelievably hard right now, but I don't really have access to the place where the work is being done.
And so in the hour ahead, we have conversations with different people who approach this. And it's fascinating, isn't it, to discover how Sarah Jones finds her way into a character, to discover how Lee Smolin looks at it as a scientific process.
The idea for me to connect up all these different heads and see that everybody in their own way is working in this way, to me, is just an exciting prospect. It takes something very lonely and very scary and mysterious and makes it just lovely and exciting and human.
I think everybody who has been involved in any kind of creative project has some suspicion of what that is. What's interesting to me is that you found somebody who could recreate it. Your friend, Freddie?
Yes, my very dear and brilliant friend, Freddie Knope, who lives in Berlin and is a musicologist and a composer. You know, when we were building this, I just had this idea of sort of trying to capture in sort of a soundscape, how does it feel to sort of get into that state? So we asked Freddie to paint a picture with sound. You sit down to write a character, and, you know, first it's a man, then it's a woman, then he's tall, then he's short, then she's old, then she's Japanese, then she's Croatian, then she's a pizza, then she's a shoe, then she's back to a lady, then she's your dog. Like, that's what's supposed to happen in the drafting, because you are literally working from infinite negative space and you are building a world. Conscious you is sitting down and saying, I have a story to tell, and you are thinking of that story and you are building that story. That is conscious me sitting down to work at a craft.
A line between consciousness and subconscious.
There's
I mean, that's really what it is.
Like, hopefully, every day, if you're lucky, hopefully something falls away, the knee falls away, the craft falls away, everything falls away, and something is being written. The example I always go to, which sort of best sums it up for me, is from childhood. I just remember this notion where it's how people learn to ride a bike. Somebody's running behind you, holding the seat, and said, I got you, I won't let go. Where it's hyper, where hyper stiff, someone's holding me, all of that stuff, and then you're just, without any awareness, you're flying. And then you're flying, and then you look back and see your dad and your mom and everyone smiling at the top of the hill, and that's when you crash into a tree or another car or go flying and get the gravel in your knee. But it's that notion where you're doing something that you don't think you can do without the awareness of it, and the awareness of it is the end. It's the end of that flying. Consciousness is sort of, I was going to say the antidote, but we don't want an antidote for this thing. We want to die of this poison of creativity. You know what I'm saying? It's, and you know, sometimes you can flutter at that consciousness and understand it's like the music coming up, like, sir, it's the end of this show.
That was composer Freddie Knoop and our guest producer for this hour, writer Nathan Englander. Does it hurt to have somebody see so clearly inside your head?
Oh, it's lovely. It's downright touching for someone to invest in a thought that way.
Nathan, we're trying to figure out just what happens when the muse descends, when creative problems are being solved. Our next guest won both a Tony and an Obie Award for her one-woman show, Bridge and Tunnel. Why did you want us to talk with Sarah Jones?
Sarah is honestly a great genius. There is literally nobody else who does what she does. Sarah builds one-woman shows out of a number of different characters. That's such a wild oversimplification of what she does because she's not doing voices and she's not doing impressions. So it's not just musculature and tone and body movement and outfit and all these things. It is reference points and taste and touch memory. She is that other person, and that is what it takes to write fiction. And she's the only person who's not writing fiction that I know who works in that way.
Here then is Sarah Jones talking with N. Strange Champs.
Sarah, you just got back from a season working in Europe. Are you developing any new characters?
Well, it's possible that I am starting something. I have a few ideas. I will let people know.
My new Italian friend is starting to gestate a little bit. She's not really ready for consumption, though, so I apologize.
Does she have a name yet?
She doesn't even have a name. She's really the character equivalent of a zygote. That was not supposed to happen.
Now, do you think of them as characters or friends? I noticed you called her your friend.
Hey, my friend. I think it's fair to say that they've done enough for me in my life as a writer and performer that they are definitely friends and somewhat family members. You know, some of them really are based on people I actually grew up around. So I think the rest of them have also become that important to me.
So you're doing right now, so you're doing the thing that I always find so puzzling that writers do. You talk about your characters you created and invented as if they're real people who could, you know, walk into the room and say hi and eat something with us, but they're all you.
You know, they really are, besides being inventions of mine, they've been with me for so long and have so kind of taken on their own, not just the characteristics I try. Obviously, I try to imbue them with real detail, you know, the timbre of their voices. I mean, somebody who has been with me longer is Lorraine Levine.
And, you know, the way she talks and the way her voice is and the way her hands and her cadence, her speech, everything about it. Of course, it's extremely important to Sarah as a writer. But I'm a real person. I don't know why you don't want to believe that, Anne, but I'm here. And I'm not queer, but I'm queer friendly, and I'm not going anywhere.
So it is astounding to listen to you transform into a character between breaths, you do that. How does that work?
Well, I think the process is one of getting myself out of the way, which is more of a relief than one might think. It's not, you know, sometimes I used to kind of think, oh, this is really difficult. It's actually freeing because once I've done enough of the, I guess the trust exercise is one way to think of it. As a writer, I try to cobble together all the details that I think this person needs to become a fully realized human being, at least in my mind's eye, enough for me to then make you believe as an audience member that this person, you know, has hopes and dreams and all of that.
So is that a really conscious, thought-out craft part? Are you thinking, okay, I think she likes wearing gray and her voice is a little husky. I mean, do you have a whole backstory and list of details?
At the very beginning, yes. You know, I sort of feel like I'm sitting in a laboratory and adding a drop of this and a, you know, smattering of that to my beaker and there's smoke pouring out of, you know, I feel a little bit like Dr. Frankenstein. But for me, the character has a lot of say in what the final product will be. If I'm trying to guide the character in a particular way because I'm hoping she'll sound more like this or I'd like her to fit, you know, this particular storyline and it's not working, it's immediately apparent to me. And I don't think that's anything that I have. I think it's something that comes from having observed people. And I guess I've just practiced long enough that when the character doesn't feel true, it is immediately apparent. And I really have to give over to whatever there. I don't know. There's just sort of an impulse that comes from the character and I have to follow it or I won't be able to go anywhere with that particular individual.
You're doing it again. That's exactly what novelists have said. You know, they'll say things like, oh, I wanted the story to go this way, but the characters wouldn't let me. And I'm thinking, what? They wouldn't let your writing, right? Whose hand holds the pen?
Right. Whose hand holds the pen? Well, I think it's almost, in my case, whose hand holds the compass? There's a kind of a true north. I went to the UN school. I was surrounded by people from a million different countries from, you know, a very early age. And so I learned
what does it, you know, what is it when the French teacher is very upset and she's starting to, begin to be so upset that, we will either be dismissed or, guillotined, I don't know.
That experience sort of lodged itself in my brain in such a way that now I can kind of listen to maybe someone I've never encountered before and find my way to a new character who has a true north. And I do. I have to follow that guidance.
You know, it's like listening to somebody who's a quintuple lingual or multilingual, the way you slip in and out. You know, when people are multilingual, you get to the point where you can think in more than one language. So do you feel like when you slide in and out of these characters, these personas, are you thinking their thoughts?
You know, that's a great question. And I'm up to my elbows in that idea at this moment because I'm writing for a couple of new projects. I've begun to dream as some of my characters. I don't know whether this should be, you know, I should be celebrating or panicking and calling for some help. But it does begin to happen that as I try to perceive the world through their eyes. I really do try to sort of clear myself out of the way, making as much space as I possibly can for another person's viewpoint and culture and background to be dominant, to be my worldview. If I do that enough and I practice it enough and I'm really immersed in that character for a time, I find that I walk around my house and will sort of,
you know, whatever are the little things that I am thinking, I need to water this plant, I would like to do this thing or that thing, suddenly I find that I want to be more Jordanian as I am doing that. And instead of just going to the store, I think to myself, when will I be able to, you know, have time for prayers or this kind of thing. These are ideas which start coming to me almost independent of me when I am in the work.
I'm going back and forth between different ideas about the self as I'm listening to you. I think you said you kind of move yourself out of the way. Do the characters feel like people who are moving inside you?
I think for the most part, I mean, I really do get to kind of escape myself in a lovely way. They really do kind of take up residence for a time and give me an alternative perspective that I wouldn't otherwise have. I mean, I, you know, my rapper character, I'll,
you know, he gonna tell me like, yeah, I Sad Jones, you know what I'm saying? Like, you feminist and all that, you know what I'm saying? I respect that and whatnot. But I'm saying, you know what I'm saying? Young ladies be walking down the street in their clothes, you know what I'm saying? Whatever, they got some nice jeans on, whatever, and then they want to, you know what I'm saying? They don't want you to look. It's like, all right, well, you know what I'm saying? Get some baggier clothes, whatever.
So, you know, in my opinion, that's ridiculous. But when I listen to Rashid say it, I understand that there's a place at which that dialogue, I can meet him there and engage him from there instead of just thinking, you moron, stop looking at my butt when I walk down the street. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. And I'm thinking it's really interesting because usually when we think about mimicry, which is, I mean, what you do is at a much higher level of art than mimicry. But we think of mimicry as a kind of making fun of someone else, whereas what you do is so tender. There's more compassion in it, I guess.
Thank you for the compliment. I really take that to heart. It's because it is a challenging thing. It's very easy for them to become stereotypes, two-dimensional. Let's trot them out for the funny accent. It's such a gift. It's such a gift to get to sit and speak to the people who, you know, let me interview them or to have grown up around the people I've encountered during my life. I mean, I'm not a religious person, but if I have one, it's probably Orthodox people lover.
So how do you begin to build a new character? How do you find one? Do you just walk down the street and you hear a voice and think, oh, that?
Well, it really depends. Sometimes I have to make counterintuitive decisions. So the person I pass on the street who seems larger than life and seems like they'd fill up a theater, sometimes the quietest character is the one who has the most compelling point of view to offer for a certain piece. And that's taken me time to discover.
For example?
Well, I have, for example, there's a character, and I hesitated to do this because I thought, oh, there are so many Southerners out there. So many people do Southern characters. But I've been working on this this young woman, young lady. And first of all, I just want to say that it's such an honor to be on your program. But I actually learned about some humanitarian crises that are happening outside our country. And for me, I just, you know, I grew up Southern Baptist. And recently I was introduced through some yoga and my yoga teacher to just some like Buddhist ideas. And as strange as it might sound, it has been like so eye-opening for me to just like, I'm still, you know, the same Southern girl, I'm still Baptist, but I almost think of myself like Buddhism and some of the things that I'm learning, they're so peaceful. They're like such peaceful people. You know, I started to think like maybe in my heart somewhere I could be like a Southern Baptist, you know, like a Buddhist Baptist or something. But I just, you know, I feel like even if people don't, you know, automatically think that somebody like me would have something to say that they could relate to, I still just, I want to say my, you know, say my little part. So so that is another person who is, you know, gestating. She's got layers to her that I didn't, think she would have. And I've been surprised in my own process.
Sarah Jones talking with Anne Strangechamps. Sarah Jones was there, but there were a lot of other people in the room. Is that what you, Nathan Englander, find when you're working on a novel?
I wouldn't find it in my head because I would cease to be, and the other people who are present would just be present. She's the perfect person. What better example of not a split consciousness, but like another consciousness that is real? I can't think of anything that says it better than Sarah saying that she wakes up from a dream and she has been dreaming as somebody else.
When you're writing a character, you're thinking their thoughts.
I am thinking my thoughts, pretending to be their thoughts, until I work on it day after day after day, month after month, and at some point, it's them thinking their thoughts. She gives us a bit of a new character and sort of apologizes for it because it's not cooked yet. It sounds pretty good to me, but I understand what she's saying.
Okay. An artist who does the same kind of work you do, but in a different sphere. It makes sense that you should work in some of the same ways. We have more to talk about than that, though. After this break, we'll take a look at creative problem solving, not just in art, but in science. Want to tell us about your creative projects? Send us a note on Facebook or find us on Twitter. The handle's TTBook1. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. In this hour of To the Best of Our Knowledge, Nathan Englander is our guest producer. He is a novelist, playwright, short story writer. His most recent book, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, won the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award and was a finalist for the 2013 Pulitzer Prize. And Nathan, you've put together this show to explore just what happens when the muse descends. So far, we've heard from artists, but two of our guests today look at this same process from a different angle. Who's next?
We're going to listen to Lee Smolin next. And if this thing that I'm so interested in is so boutique or only works with, you know, delicate literary fiction writers on our fainting couches, that, to me, the idea does not hold up. If this is something real about thought and ideas, it should work for the physicists. It should work across form, across world. And yes, let us talk to some brilliant people in other forms. How does the theoretical physicist think?
I think what we'll find is very exciting. The theoretical physicist, Lee Smolin, does in fact approach his work in some of the same ways that you do. Here's Steve Paulson talking with him.
Lee, when you're working on a physics problem, how do you go about trying to solve it?
I drive myself crazy with its difficulty. I read other people's attempts to solve the problem. It's necessary to know a lot about the history of the problem you're working on to have a new idea. You have to immerse yourself in some cases for years in a problem before you get to the point where you have a good new idea. You have to have a lot of bad ideas. As Dick Feynman once said to me, you have to be prepared to make every possible mistake and have every possible stupid idea before you can have the right idea. And I make sketches. Since I'm trained as a theoretical physicist, I like to play with mathematics. I like to play with mathematical ideas. So I'll make a little model which illustrates some aspect of it and play with it, see what I can derive from it. Talk and conversation plays a big role in the kind of science I do. I'll talk with friends, with colleagues, with students.
So you want to be able to bounce your ideas off other people and see what they say, whether you're on to something.
You need, yes. Different people need different amounts of that. Another thing I do is I take walks. I lie in bed and stare at the ceiling. I go sailing. I play music all the time. I'm sort of thinking about things.
So when you go sailing, for instance, is that a creative space for you to come up with good ideas?
It has been. Sailing creates a sense of focus, the sense of flow when everything disappears but the focus on the wind and the water. And sometimes when I come in from sailing, I find my head is cleared and I can think a new thought, or I find a new thought in my mind.
So it's not as if you're trying to sort out your physics problems while you're sailing, but it's something happens in your mind that makes space for you to think in a new way?
If I wanted to swim, I'd just be swimming. If I tried to think about my physics problems while I was sailing, I would be, you know, in the slowest position of all with respect to the wind, which is upside down.
Now, I know there are big problems in physics and small problems as well. I mean, there are probably sort of daily problems you're working on, and then there are the big cosmic questions about the universe, the kinds of things that you wrestle with. Do you approach those problems in different ways?
I think it's more a question of time scale, because at any one time, I'm working on a large number of different things, or it seems a large number of different things. I have a couple of papers in progress usually at any one time. I'm struggling at any one time with some technical problems, which hopefully get solved, with some middle-level problems, trying to invent a new strategy, and with some basic foundational problems, which I've been struggling with for my whole career, like the nature of quantum mechanics or the nature of cosmology. And all of these different questions are going on at the same time, and sometimes they illuminate each other, sometimes they don't.
So how does it feel when you do get an answer or a solution does present itself? Is there a story you could tell about what it's like to solve a problem?
Well, the problem is that I've only definitively solved the small-scale problems.
That's all
I've
right.
I've had ideas about bigger problems. I mean, a few years ago, I went to a cafe, which I'd never been to before, and I realized that I'd been working on the same idea about quantum mechanics for a long time, and I said to myself, this is boring, this is frustrating. I want to have a new idea about quantum mechanics. And I opened a new notebook and took out a pen and sat there, took a few sips of coffee, and this is the only time this has ever happened to me. Remarkably, a new idea about quantum mechanics came to my mind in a matter of a minute. And I thought, oh, that's funny. Of course, once you have an idea, there's a lot of work to do because you're responsible for the idea. You have to see if you can make a mathematical framework that encapsulates the idea, that expresses the idea, that you can then draw deductions from and draw conclusions from. And there's a lot of things to check whether it's really going to work or not. So that was the beginning of a hard, frustrating period of several months before everything was checked out enough to write a paper.
Was this an aha moment?
That was definitely an aha moment. That was one of the good ones.
Oh, there are bad ones?
Well, there are sort of, oh, aha, I've been stupid. Most aha moments are about one's own mistakes and one's own stupidity. Oh, my God. You know, I've had the wrong factor of two in that equation for a week, and that's why that term isn't canceling. That's what most aha moments are like. Ah, that term has to cancel, because if it didn't cancel, something would depend on the cosmological constant, but this is the radius of a sphere in space, and it can't know about the cosmological constant. So that factor of two had better be wrong, but my God, now I got to find it. It's like crawling painfully up a cliff. Not that I have fear of heights, so that's not something I would ever do, but I imagine that it's like, you know, after days of searching, you find the right handhold and you can go one more step.
What do you think happened there? I mean, why do you think somehow your mind opened up so that, you know, this new idea popped into your head?
I have no idea. When it comes to the hard foundational problems of quantum mechanics, there are five or six different approaches. And I'd been working all within one approach for my whole life, really. And this was a different kind of approach. And it just came to me. I have no idea where it came from.
Well, have you found that breakthroughs in physics tend to come through intuitive insight or through hard-headed, analytical, linear thinking?
Both, they come together. The intuition motivates the hard slogging, and the hard slogging prepares your mind for the intuition, for the insight. You know, it's like being a musician. You have to do your scales. You have to practice every day. You have to be technically fit and good at what you're doing and in practice in order to get anywhere. The point about doing something creative, at least this kind of thing, is that there's a high level of technical work and discipline and craft involved, and there's also a high level of intuition and ambition and insight, and they play off each other.
Hearing you talk about your life as a physicist and, you know, trying to work out creative problems, it raises all kinds of questions about how that compares to what an artist does, whether creativity works the same way there as it does for a scientist like you. Do you have any sense of that?
I have a small sense because I do have some good friends who are visual artists. And I think that there is the same need for a combination of hard work and discipline and craft and imaginative insight and ambition. I mean, I don't think art has the same goals as science, except very, very broadly to enlarge our humanity. An artist who's a master is able both to be a master of the craft and to bring forth surprising new works which stun you with their profundity and their insight. One of my artist friends, St. Clair Semin, a Brazilian sculptor in New York, said to me once that in science you try to go from the particular to the general, and in art, at least art as he does it, he tries to go from the particular to the even more particular.
Hmm. Do you find that you, when you are most creative, do you think you're in some kind of a different brain state?
I don't know. There is an experience of focus, of flow, of being caught up in it. I don't think that this is special for science. I think many, many human activities, there is this sense of being totally immersed, of flowing. Athletes must experience this, and artists. There is a thing, though, which is common, which is the recalcitrance of your materials. And the point about science is that you're up against nature, and the tools that you use, you can't just wish them to work. You have to work painfully with them and develop them. And similarly, if you're a sculptor, the qualities and the properties of the materials that you're working with are not yours to invent. You work with materials that have their own properties that are recalcitrant to your will. It's this confrontation of your will and your desire to bring something forth with a medium that resists you, that sometimes it seems is trying in every way to defeat your ambition and your desire. It's that confrontation that creative work comes from.
Now, if we were to draw, again, some parallels between, let's say, what a novelist does and what you do as a physicist, and one thing a fiction writer typically does is create a world and create a universe, and which has to hang together in some way. And I'm wondering if you feel like you are, to some degree, creating the story of the universe or trying to find a way to tell the story of the universe.
There is a difference here, and I'm such an admirer of fiction writers. As somebody who writes nonfiction and cares a lot about doing it well, I can only imagine how much more challenging fiction is. See, I want to agree with you and then disagree. In science, we try to tell stories as ways of illuminating the world we live in, for sure. But the difference is that we require that our stories be checkable against nature. So the best stories can turn out to be false. In fact, the best stories usually turn out sooner or later to be false in science, which isn't to say that there isn't a sense in which a great novel captures something true about humanity in it, about the possible characters in it. But it's a different kind of truth and a different kind of confrontation with the truth that distinguishes a good scientific story from a good novel.
It's often said that theoretical physics is a young person's game, that all the major breakthroughs come from people under the age of 30. Do you think that's true?
I hope it's not true. My sense is that there is something important about being fresh. And I think it's important to change problems one works on, to change viewpoints, to change approaches, so as not to get too stale. There is a thing about, You know, when I was a postdoc, I knew Chandrasekhar, the great astrophysicist, who was then in his 70s. And he used to muse with me about things like this. And his point of view was that most people burn themselves out either by failing to achieve their ambitions and becoming bitter and not being able to put in the effort to do something else, or by becoming too attached to their own legacy and too defensive about their reputation. And his point of view was that there was nothing biologically that happened to you, but he said it was necessary to completely change fields and change directions every 10 years to stay fresh.
So the trick then, if you want to stay creative, is to, what, to take on new problems, new questions?
Yes, and look, any given problem, after a few years working on it, you've either solved it or you haven't. And if you solve it, that's great. Now you can go on to something else. And if you haven't solved it, after a few years of working on it, you're unlikely to be the person who solves that problem, if indeed that problem is solvable at all. A lot of problems go away as science progresses because they turn out to be just not interesting or not relevant in the light of future developments.
That's theoretical physicist Lee Smolin talking with Steve Paulson. He's a founding member of the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics. His research areas include the quantum theory of gravity, cosmology, and quantum field theory. Nathan, I was watching you as we both listened to this conversation with Lee Smolin. Your eyes would widen. You'd say, yes. It's fascinating to me that somebody whose world is different from yours is in many ways in exactly the same space that you're in.
Well, firstly, Lee Smolin speaks the gospel. That's why my reactions. I couldn't have expected hearing anything better from a theoretical physicist than what I just heard. It just rang deeply true to me. And, you know, honestly, it makes me feel a lot less alone in the world. Like, that's a lovely connection. There is the challenge at hand, whether you want to build a book, build a universe, or understand what's behind that. Like, this idea, you have a challenge that you have to work on, and I love that idea. It doesn't matter, is Lee Smolin hungry? Is Lee Smolin tired? Does Lee Smolin want to go to a dinner party? His obligation is to the process, to the question, and that's the whole point. You need to give your consciousness over to the matter at hand.
You have to make sure that you've gone through everything wrong before you can hope to get to the right.
But this is the notion of how writing works, where he talks about, I drive myself crazy and I have to like go through every possible wrong answer before I get the right answer. This is the idea I love to hear in a separate field, that he recognizes that it is a matter of discipline and training, all the work before and all the work after, but you need to be there present for the moment.
This is all fascinating, and there is more to come. We'll be back in a moment with your conversation with David Krakauer, the head of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. In this hour, Nathan Englander is our guest producer. Nathan, you're a novelist, a short story writer, a playwright, and you've joined us to explore creative states. So this final interview is with David Krakauer. He is both an evolutionary biologist and director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. Why did you want to talk to David?
There are about 900 reasons, not least of which is he is a very unique kind of mind, and maybe 900 more after we got to talking. But David's a big advocate advocate for collaboration across disciplines, and he's fascinated by questions of creativity, as am I, and I basically wanted to ask him what might be happening in the brain, in the human brain, in the writer's brain, in the creative brain, in my own noggin. We started out with that question, and he's just a generous man, so it really turned pretty quickly into a warm, fast-paced back-and-forth conversation.
So I work on the evolution of intelligence from the Big Bang to the brain, right? So
yes.
Over very long periods of time. And obviously, what you're describing, very, very rarefied, high-order states of consciousness, about which very little, I think, it would be fair to say, is known neuroscientifically. You know, left and right hemispheres don't always agree, and the connective tissue between the hemispheres, the corpus callosum, enforces agreement that the left hemisphere turns out to be a bit of a bully, the linguistically dominant side of your brain, and so enforces coherence, which might not exist. So it could be that you sort of liberate a little bit parts of the brain from the yoke of the left hemisphere, and so that might be, and this is purely speculation, what we're experiencing when we experience these sort of somehow multiple states of mind. What I do believe is that there are sort of dominant modes of thinking, and they're so dominant that they utterly eclipse other processes that might be running in parallel. And you have to do something consciously to make them visible or make them apparent. It's like listening to very loud sounds and then a little sparrow tweeting in the background and you being completely oblivious of it. I think that that's like consciousness to me. And there are certainly drugs and processes and rituals that might enable us to become more aware of these sort of below the threshold processes, which otherwise we miss. And so, but I wouldn't call it an altered state of consciousness. I'd rather call them parallel states of consciousness, each of which has a different amplitude.
Well, so then is it, as whatever kind of animal we are as beings, that we then want to use it for creativity? Because we need to ask evolutionary. I think of my dog that I'm obsessed with. I aspire to that level of focus. You know, it's exactly what I work for creatively. Whatever genetically makes her want to get that ball, like you can set her on fire, you could run her through a minefield. When that turns on, everything falls away.
The single-mindedness. It's interesting, by the way. I mean, some people have claimed that single-mindedness of that sort is incompatible with creativity. They famously, actually, in the 19th century, Poincaré, who's a great mathematician and a great theorist on his own mind. In fact, oddly enough, the two communities were really thoughtful on their own minds, introspectively, mathematical physicists and drug users. And what Poincaré would do is he would do what you're describing, be single-minded and fixated, sort of extreme precision and focus. And then he'd leave it alone. And he'd go and dream, or he'd walk or take the tram. And that was the moment where the extreme discipline yielded its rewards. You couldn't do one on or the other in isolation. It was just exactly that combination that he needed. And he wrote, I think, very eloquently on this and made serious discoveries in mathematics in that phase of being released from the discipline.
I hope he had good water pressure, because I was just talking to someone about the shower. This is the shower, yeah, like those exactly. Moments that come where you're hammering, and then you take a good shower. You know, I trained for years as a lazy suburban child, which is focus, 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 stop watching TV. But now I train really hard to try and work 6 days a week, to take this break and take this walk. I didn't understand that the day off is actually more productive, that the brain needs to cycle.
I'm just curious. I mean, I'll turn this around and ask you a question. I mean, I want to get to this notion of one of the big differences between being a scientist, at least post the scientific revolution, and being a writer, because science is collective, it's communitarian, it's collaborative. There really aren't isolated contributions to science. I mean, do you feel that you would be a better writer if you could write collaboratively? Would it completely undermine the entire exercise?
The answer to your question is New York. Yeah. It's insane for writers to live in New York. We don't work anywhere. We don't need a job. Everything's astoundingly expensive, but we do group together, sort of like creative lemmings. There's a reason for it. Even just talking about process is enriching, but I just did my first play last year, and that was mind-boggling for me to see other people.
Because it was so collaborative.
This notion that we're building a story together for once, and one person's job is to think about light. And one person's job is to think about sound. I was watching a scene and it was almost there. Then we're all like, that's it, this is it. And our sound engineer had added just the tiniest little ticking. I couldn't believe that changed things. So as somebody who works on groups and collaborates endlessly scientifically, can people teach each other to think differently? Does it help the process?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I tend to think about this idea of thinking and creativity at scales, right? So there's individuals, Einstein, Shakespeare.
Heard of them.
Right, and you've heard of them. And that's what we aspire to. And most of the educational system is sort of built, in some sense, to support, foster that kind of creativity, which is misguided. Then there's, you know, the institutions. And so those emphasize the collectives. And I think science is very much in that tradition. There's no idea, I think, that you could identify that significant post-19th century in science that wasn't in some form or other collaboratively arrived at. I mean, Einstein, if you think about the whole notion of space-time in the general theory of relativity, this came from Minkowski. I mean, this was someone else's idea, which he learned. He realized, oh, that would be useful. That's the right way to think about space and time. So absolutely smart people learn from each other, and they seek each other out. I think that the communal collective side tends to be deprecated because I think it's harder to understand.
Well, that's fine. We have one of my writer's poker games. It's got to be like 12 years old now. And you know, when someone brings a friend, they think like, this is what you guys talk about, because they expect us to be having these high-minded conversations. And it's just, that's not what we come together for. You know, we're there to play cards and talk about nonsense. I can't tell you how enriching those friendships are to me. It's being around people sick with the same disease. I really do think story is the supreme form. There's nothing else that we construct wholly in our own brain. Writing, I feel like it's the one thing where it literally becomes our consciousness.
I want to challenge this, actually. I mean, it's interesting. Let me do two remarks about this. So one about, you know, Einstein very famously was very disparaging about language because he was constantly asked this question. He said, professor, you're such a creative man. Tell us how you do it. And he said, well, I absolutely do not do it linguistically. He says, that's the last little sort of epiphenomenal bubble that occurs at the very end, which I need to impose on my creative thought in order to communicate with
to
you.
To communicate,
right?
Sure, yeah.
And so, but interestingly enough, he felt that he was recombining symbols. He even describes it in terms of motion, actually, Einstein, interestingly enough, but never in terms of language. So that's an interesting distinction right there. There are people who can only think linguistically and others who feel language is the very last thing that they have to recruit.
I actually wholly agree with that. The genesis of it is outside of language. I sometimes have sentences, I'll use the wrong word. So sometimes I'll build things out of the wrong word just for the feel, the rhythm. Yes, it is outside of language in its conception. In that moment of dissociative state, I agree with Einstein. Is that good?
All right, that's a good thing. No, well, not always, right? I mean, he wasn't right about everything.
So to get all personal right in the moment, I'm starting a new book. I know this book for years. I know that other part of self, it's clearly been cooking. And I feel like these strange days, you know, I'm pondering full time. It's just such a strange notion. People who are serious about their ideas have to work. Composing many hours a day, drafting, redrafting, you know, whatever it is that we take from infinity. And it's something that has no form. My book doesn't have language yet. Would you like to buy it as a publisher? I have a book for you. It has not even words yet. All ideas come from this primordial intellectual space.
So I'm thinking about metaphor here. It is linguistic, but it's not necessarily narrative. The Origin of Species is a beautiful example, right? If you wanted to, you could go away and read that book in terms of the metaphors that worked as you go through the first or the sixth edition, and the metaphors that failed. And so, the metaphors that work, people know, I mean, the evolutionary tree is a metaphor that worked, right? The metaphor that got expurgated in subsequent editions was the wedge. I mean, no one thinks of the wedge when they think of Darwin, right? It's absolutely ubiquitous in scientific reasoning. And so in that early, that sort of manic phase you're describing now, I'm guessing that a lot of it has to do with finding these powerful, productive metaphors, which then, through some rather interesting process, get fleshed out.
Honest to goodness, that's a gift for me to hear right now. That's really helpful. That's a lovely, lovely way to see it.
So it's very peculiar. It's this very, and in fact, it's so weird that one of the great physicists, Eugene Vigner, he wrote this essay called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics. And he was asking exactly this question. He said, look, I invoke this metaphor to explain something. And in the case he was interested in, it was in antimatter. And I write down these equations for the hydrogen atom, and they work. But then I get these results, and they say that I should find these negative solutions. Now, most of us would just throw them away because they say, yeah, that's the mathematics being stretched beyond its limit. But he said, no, you know, I'm going to treat them as true and impose that on reality. And it turns out he predicts antimatter.
That is exactly the writing problem. I mean, what I hear when you're telling that story is also about intellectual honesty. Like, we can tell what's true in voice, which is why it works through translation. I pick up Gogol and it's, you know, Russian to English in 100 years. And from word one, I was like, this is a truth teller. And I have to say, the only compliments, the one thing that I process is when people come up to me who have experienced things that I've only dreamed and say, how did you know? There was an order to the world. There's an order to numbers. I really feel like story functions by those same rules.
That's David Krakauer, director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, talking with Nathan Englander, our guest producer for this hour. Story functions by those same rules. That's actually the whole concept of the show, isn't it, Nathan?
Yes. I guess that's it. You know, it's hard to quantify these things, but I really, really deeply believe, you know, that that's why certain stories work across time and space, why they touch us in that way, is because there is an order to the world. You know, there's a mathematical order and there's an emotional order.
You're talking about the same thing.
I am as surprised as you are to hear that. You know, like I can't even tell you, sitting here and listening to what has turned into a show, I'm touched and amazed at how the truth of it really does seem to cross form and cross from mind to mind.
Nathan, the premise of this show was to explore what it is when the muse descends. Do you think we've done that?
Yeah, I on my end, these things that I believe, that I wanted to explore, that I want to talk about, yeah, honestly, I feel both sort of empowered and more connected at the end of this.
Well, I would just add that what you've described, and it's a comfort, I think, to us, is that what you do is so very similar to what we do. So having Nathan Englander guest produced, to the best of our knowledge, turns out to have been just about perfect.
You're so nice. This has been a life-changing experience for me, just a real, real joy. Thank you for letting me into your form.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can hear more of Nathan's conversation with David Krakauer on our website, ttbook.org, or find us on SoundCloud. They talk about reading and writing in a digital age, how to evaluate contributions to art and science, and a whole lot more. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for When the Muse Descends. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Nathan Englander and Sarah Nix, with help from Doug Gordon and Strange Champs and Charles Monroe Kane. Thanks to Freddie Canope for letting us use cuts from his album Polyphonies. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.